the show.
August 3rd, 1990, and the modern Irish rock festival is born.
It was like Sodom and Gomorrah. It was like sort of a scene from a Mad Max film or something.
Thurless.
Under no circumstances should we allow young people to dance on the sacred soil of Simple Stadium.
Fela.
Apparently there were members of the audience who were horrified. Probably horrified that she didn't take her knickers off as well.
This is the untold story.
There was an organic sort of sense as well that maybe some of this wasn't right for Thurless.
Of the trip to Tiff.
Somebody is going to be awful sorry they threw this title roll away sometime tonight, I'd say.
You've heard it often enough, but the period from 1989 to 1994 was one of the most condensed times of social change in Ireland and indeed the world. The fall of the wall, the end of the Haughey era, Mary Robinson.
Come dance with me in Ireland.
The Eurovision wins, U2, Bishop Casey, ole ole ole.
The nation holds its breath. Yes, we're there!
And providing the soundtrack to all this change, a music festival for a new generation. The late 80s were a bleak time for live music here. Listoon and Siamse were a distant memory, and Slane had closed for business. Stuart Clark of Hot Press.
Back then you had, I don't know, the Butter Queen Festival somewhere in the wilds of Offaly where you might get like a cabaret band playing. But the idea of a successful American or UK act actually coming in to play in Ireland outside of Dublin, maybe Cork, was just, you know, la-la stuff. Well, we kept on hearing from people about McCroom and Liz Doon Varner, but that was like 10 years ago. It was a distant memory. So you didn't get, you know, two-day festivals. And I remember when MCD announced Fela going, oh my God, this is incredible. Will it work? I was 20, 22, living in Waterford. You'd travel up to Dublin to see Saxon at the SFX, the odd gig at the National Stadium. Don't forget, I don't think The Point was on stream, or if it was at the time, it'd only been open a couple of years. This was an incredible thing. You know, my pop psychology is the two things that changed the Irish psyche in the 80s were U2 conquering the world and that swine Ray Houghton putting the ball in the English net. Those two things made the country sort of come of age and sort of go, hey, you know, we can compete with the big boys. We can actually beat them. We can have an act at number one in America, and we can have a football team that goes to major tournaments and beats the old enemy. So maybe sort of failure was feeding into that sort of feel-good factor and we can do it attitude.
Broadcaster and musician Tom Dunn.
The sense of Ireland coming out of the recession of the 20th century, really, the breaking the church's hold, it was all going off, it was all kicking off. It started in 88, but it was all kicking off in 1990, and the sense of a country being optimistic about its future and great football team, great local bands. There was an awful lot of really great things in the pot at that time.
The seeds of the idea that would become Ireland's first rock and roll multi-day festival were sown on the night Tipperary won the All-Ireland in 1989.
Tipperary have bridged an 18-year gap. They're the worthy champions. And these Tip fans have travelled the country in support of their team.
Michael Lowry was the local North Tipperary Fine Gael TD. He was also on the County Council, the Health Board, and was chairman of the Semple Stadium Fundraising Committee.
In 1984, Tipperary put forward Semple Stadium for the centenary All-Ireland hurling final. But when the All-Ireland was held in 1984, and no sooner had the cheering died down and everybody had left, it became very apparent that there was a huge debt there. And the debt at that stage was in the region of, well, I think it was in excess of 1.2 million. We had reached a situation where the revenue that was accruing from day-to-day activities of the GAA wasn't even enough to pay the interest on it. And with the team went on then to win the All-Ireland in 89. The homecoming, we met them at Simpa Stadium. And I organised that night to have Joe Dolan play. It generated huge atmosphere on the night. It was a brilliant night. And it did. That night I said, you know, this could be something, a concept that can be developed in a form or way. And I went about doing that.
Thank you very much. God bless you. Love to see you soon. Bye.
I made an approach. I know we approached at the time. I didn't directly approach, but I sent somebody who was connected or who knew Aikens to the late Jim Aiken. And I went directly myself. The first man I actually met was of MCD was Eamon McCann. I met Eamon McCann in the Westbury Hotel. I gave him an idea of what I was thinking and asked them would they be interested. And they showed the most enthusiasm and the trip to Tip was born.
Now you know, the modern Irish rock festival that spans Witness, Oxygen and Electric Picnic began with a Joe show. MCD Promotions in 1989 had never run a multi-day festival. Justin Green is their head of marketing and began working with the company at that time.
Well, prior to Fela, I suppose we would have been doing one-off shows as such, one-day shows, whereby you might have had two or three acts on a lineup and that was it. You know, if you look at the acts that were actually touring in around that time, you know, in the late 80s, you would have had REM doing a couple of nights at the RDS, as in indoors, but they all would have been one-day, one evening single events. Michael Lowry, you know, came up with the concept, wanted to hold an event that would actually bring people to Thurles, to the heart of the GAA, the where it all began. He wanted to do something different. The event would have never happened without Michael Lowry. When you have someone like Michael Lowry on the ground who is putting the infrastructure and gathering support of both industry, the local council, the local business association, and actually the community. And when you have someone on the ground, you know, who is involving them and keeping them abreast of everything and putting it together and the logistics on the ground together, it makes it a lot easier for a promoter to be able to focus on the arcs. Michael actually focused primarily on setting up the infrastructure down there, dealing with all the authorities, whereas we focused on putting together the best possible lineup that we could actually do. You know, festivals, multi-day festivals had happened around Europe, it happened in the States. This was a festival of the calibre of lineup and over a number of days of work camping, and it was unique to Ireland at that time.
My idea was that we'd run four or five bands on a day basis, and then when we sat down and considered it and we said why not go and make a weekend of it. So before we knew it, we were up and running on Friday, Saturday and Sunday.
The local paper in Thurles is the Tipperary Star. Eugene Hogan was the journalist charged with covering the reaction on the ground to the proposal.
All the ingredients were there so that he became the only person really that could put all of this together. He was TD, he was on the health board. I think at the same time he was also a councillor. I think you could still be a TD and a councillor at the time. Obviously he was a hugely influential figure in the GA. So nobody else, irrespective of the negatives that came with it, had the ability to bring enough people with him to make sure that this happened, and that the chance that Michael Lowry was willing to take, and that is something that certainly defined him at the time and still does, was that he was a risk taker and he was able to do that and bring people with him to enable this to happen. Without him and that makeup, it just simply wouldn't have happened.
Every great idea then needs to be realised, And the main problem to overcome wasn't campsites or portaloos or train lines, but the consent of the landlords.
We had the stadium, but there was one major problem to be overcome, and that was to get approval from County Board. We had a couple of meetings about it. It was divisive. It was a very difficult meeting. There was very strongly held views against, in opposition to it. We met with vehement opposition, and one man from Boris O'Kane standing up at the meeting and making a very emotional speech to the meeting and saying, you know, that under no circumstances should we allow young people to dance on the sacred soil of Simple Stadium, and we shouldn't have English bands on a traditional GA venue. And that was a kind of the mood of the ones that were anti. There was obviously people who had legitimate concerns about antisocial behaviour. I would say the most difficult part of actually getting the failure, the trip to tip off the ground, was the opposition within the county from within the GA itself.
It was interesting, again, because they were GA people. They were proud Thurles people, and completely opposite to, you know, the GA people and the proud Thurles people who brought the event there. So there was a clash.
After that, the objections were ones that were, what damage would it do? What kind of money were you making out of it? Was it worth the risk? Gradually what happened was I had given insurances after discussions with MCD and after having consultation with the various people involved in the venture. And we gradually got to the stage where I got approval to proceed. What was very important to the event was to engage with the local people and to get the local people to commit to the event and to see it as an opportunity rather than something that was going to burden them.
Féile 90 claims to be the largest rock music festival ever staged in this country, and it's the brainchild of the Semple Stadium Management Committee, struggling to keep its head above water under the weight of debts on the stadium, totalling over £1 million. Starting tonight with the amazing Colossal Men, Féile 90 continues until late Sunday night. By then, 24 of Ireland's
top... I'm happy that all the angles have been covered. Magella Lanigan lives in Childers Park, right next to the stadium. She is also on the local residence committee.
They assured us that the promoters for the concert would keep back a certain amount of the funds in case of damages so that we wouldn't have to pay them out of our own pocket.
Obviously, power was a big, because you were talking here about high voltage for the stadium itself, never mind say then around the town, like with people cooking and people heating and washing, and it was a massive demand on power, and we did have a blink in that, and that we had to get the ESB to do a major emergency work for us that ended up satisfactory. We had a problem with the water supply. We had to augment the water supply. This is a town of a population of 8,000 people. We had two hotels. We didn't have a network of guest houses. So our first big effort had to be to get people to engage with us in offering accommodation, and we established a register of people who were willing to make a bed available to a group or young people when they came to Thurles, and that worked particularly well.
The locals were able to pay for school uniforms or pay for the books for the next year for their kids. I mean, the first time I was at Féile in 1990, I actually stayed in a local family house. I always remember, because the whole room wallpaper was pink and it was all Disney characters, and the young girl that had actually had that room was put out of her room for that weekend, and that room was given to me. I stayed there that weekend. They made a few bob, and I tell you, it was one of the best breakfasts you'll ever have.
Then there was the minor matter of the music. Looking at the lineup for the first year in 1990, it certainly reflects the tastes of the time. Justin Green from MCD.
I suppose if you look at the lineup, the likes of Meatloaf, Big Country, Hot House Flowers, The Four of Something Happens, Van Morrison, Deacon Blue, Christian Moore, we were already representing them at the time. The reason that there was more Irish-dominated acts is not just because they're accessible, but it was also, that's what everyone wanted. There was a huge, huge demand for those acts. They were outselling a lot of other international acts. These acts were the big draws. No Sweat were all over the radio at the time with number one single. You had Moving Hearts, you had That Petrol Emotion. So there was a complete selection of artists on the lineup, but they were on the lineup primarily because they were the hottest acts at that time, and Fela brought them together.
One of these acts was Something Happens. Tom Dunn is their frontman.
They used to say in 89, 90 that Dublin was the city of 1,000 bands, and it really was, and a lot of those bands were producing great music and successful music. They were in the charts, they were topping the album charts. Forbes topped the album charts, Emotional Fish did, Hot House Flowers did, Saw Doctors did, We did. That's a lot of local indigenous bands who are selling loads of records and getting loads, and just doing it purely on the basis of quality. There's no, you know, 30% Irish quotient to put them in or anything like that. It's just, these are the songs people want to listen to. They were the top bands to book.
Yeah. Anna.
If you build it, they will come. And come to Thurles they did. As this was the pre-internet age, tickets had to be purchased in person over the counter or else at the venue. Waiting for people to arrive can be a tense affair.
The first trains arrived for the first concert. They arrived on the Thursday. You know, there was a sense of fear around, is this what's going to arrive. The train station is a couple of hundred yards from my office, and I was looking out the window and they were coming. We had the first campsite open, which is right beside my office. So they were past my window at the office and into the campsite. But I can recall looking out the window and I said, oh my God, what have we let ourselves in for here? Because it was a scruffy looking crowd. The people who had nothing else to do were effectively here on the Thursday. But when it came to Friday, those people were lost in the crowd. They were anonymous in the crowd because we had such numbers, you wouldn't see them. So I remember that first day, I was in the office and I was very nervous because I was under enormous pressure at that stage. When I looked out the window that evening and saw these guys passing through, I said, you know, to be quite honest with you, I was very nervous. And I remember sitting in the toilet bowl for about an hour, getting my composure back.
So we were flown in on the morning of the gig to Ireland and then drove down to Semple Stadium for the gig, and literally just arrived backstage about 2 hours before the gig. I could have got a lift, but I decided I wanted to drive my own car, and I just drove down. No backstage passes, no laminates, no tickets, just a vague idea that Semple Stadium should be easy to find. I arrived in Thurles and it was like the fall of Rome. People are just falling all over the place. People are buying. There's no catering. There's no toilets. And people are just buying large sliced pans and packets of ham in shops and sitting at the side of the road. There was a guy sitting on the side of the road with the sliced bread on the ground and trying to, he couldn't get the butter to melt, you know. He was used to his mother having the butter soft for him, you know. He hadn't had hard butter like this before, and as he was trying to spread it, it was just breaking the bread. And I could see the frustration on his face, and obviously a few pints on board as well, you know. It was just very funny, and I literally had to ask people which way to the stadium, you know. And then, you playing there? Yes. And then they got out of the way of the car. You know, we drove to a big metal gate and beeped the horn. A guy looks at us and says, we're on in an hour or something. Oh, yeah, yeah. Just, you know, bring the car in, park wherever you can. I'll head back to the dressing room.
The Stunning were also on the bill for that first weekend. Lead singer Steve Wall.
Driving into Thurles, and we were all in the back of the van. It was like Sodom and Gomorrah. It was like a scene from a Mad Max film or something. There was the detritus of the night before, of the Friday night. There were people had set up little stalls in their front gardens selling bowls of cornflakes and cups of tea and God knows what, anything they could sell. They'd be selling, you know, from this little table in their front garden, and then behind it someone had pitched a tent. So they were also, you know, selling a couple of square feet in the front garden as well. So I thought, in retrospect, it was hilarious, and it was Ireland. When you see festivals now, like the Electric Picnic and all these boutique festivals, and it's all laid out and it's all very like by the book and everything. But back then there was something kind of, it was almost like you could imagine it in a Roddy Doyle novel, you know what I mean? It was just people sort of being inventive. You know, necessity required you do this. You know, you have all these people hanging around, loads of kids went down and they didn't even bring a tent. There was that whole attitude as well of, let's just go down and see what happens. People stayed up all night and fell asleep on the side of the road or on the grass verge.
I was working for the Limerick Tribune, now defunct, as their music and arts correspondent, and I journeyed down to the first trip to TIP with a young pup from a rival paper called the Limerick Post called Kevin Barry. I didn't organise camping. I was meant to stay in somebody's car, the luxury, and they went missing. So another Limerick Tribune journalist, Siobhan, we found a very nice ditch just to the left of the main stand next to Semple Stadium. It was a lovely night, thank goodness. So we went into the ditch and got all these kind of dry leaves and had this as our sort of continental quilt. And we kissy-kissied and nothing happened until 2 years ago, and now we're back together again. What I think was important about Thurles, as opposed to it being Dublin or Cork, is people couldn't go home unless you lived in Thurles. And it was about much more than actually being in the stadium. It was about the crack in the morning. It was about copping off with people and going back to their tents. It was about having a pint in the pub before you went into Semple Stadium. That having to travel to somewhere, you know, nobody could claim any higher ground. You weren't so much city dwellers and colchis. You were festival goers. It was a great leveller. And like I say, once the music finished really quite early, I think there was about a 10:30, 11 o'clock curfew, the fun and games really started, but nobody went home.
Irish Times music journalist Jim Carroll began a stellar career attending music festivals, but not with pen in hand.
For the first Fela in 1990, I flogged t-shirts. That was my job. I sold t-shirts. I was one of a gang of people who came down from Dublin and were doing the merchandise at the festival. You know, we sold event t-shirts. We sold t-shirts for basically any of the bands who were appearing. And like, it gave you a really good insight as to what was going on. You know, we were selling t-shirts at a kind of a stand or a stall, which is basically at the back of the sound desk on the field. So that's kind of like was where all the action was. Looking back now, of course, you can kind of say, oh yeah, definitely, you know, everything started with Fela and Turles. You know, hindsight's wonderful, hindsight's great. And looking back now, when we do talk to people about Fela, there's this lovely look comes in their face, because they remember all the innocence and they remember all the good times. You know, I think it was a time of first for that generation. You got to remember, for many of them, it was their first time being away from mammy, it was their first time being away from home, it was the first time probably in a tent. It was definitely the first time for many of them at a music festival as well, and obviously that leads to certain things. It was probably their first serious music epiphanies, like seeing maybe an act down the bill that like really resonated with them. It's probably, for many of them, it was probably their first experience of drugs, first experience of drink.
The lineup in the first year, as we know, was predominantly Irish. In fact, 21 of 24 acts were Irish, which would be unusual, if not even impossible, at a similar event today. The only tourists were Big Country, Meatloaf and Deacon Blue. Headlining on the Saturday night were the Hothouse Flowers.
I remember everybody feeling very proud that Hothouse Flowers headlined the night after Meatloaf. And of course, you know, now they're doing their own thing, maybe in ever-decreasing circles. But on the back of the Eurovision and Don't Go and the fact that, you know, you two had opened doors, and suddenly there they were headlining a festival in Ireland. And there was a real feel-good factor about Liam and the boys, you know, getting that slot following on from Meatloaf, who had sold about like 50 gazillion records and won umpteen Grammys and was just one of the biggest artists in the world at the time. We'll be right back.
If one band epitomises the trip to tip, it's the Saw Doctors. By summer 1990, their career had stalled. Their debut single, N17, barely dented the charts. They were scheduled to appear at the first Fela Festival on the Sunday, and some members of the band saw an opportunity to make a few extra quid along the way. Here's Leo Moran.
It was particular because we started on Friday, we were working. We went down as crew. We were friendly with Pádraic Bóran and Tony Killeen here in Galway, and they brought us down, and we were doing the wristbands, putting the wristbands on people on Friday evening. I remember having a sore thumb from closing all the clips. We were having the crack anyway now for the last few wristbands and all that kind of crack, but I think I must have been having a bit too much fun, because when the team got picked to do the wristbands on the Saturday, I didn't get picked, so I had Saturday off. And then Sunday, the Saw Doctors were the first band on Sunday morning. First band after Mass, we always said.
Oh! You have to keep the rain off. So now, how are you? You enjoyed the weekend? The next song we're going to play is a song for everybody who's given us help and came to see us.
I have fallen far out. She can make her own way.
I would have brought a tent and slept in the kind of a workers' car park backstage. And so I was there for the weekend then, it was great. And Paul Kniff, who had co-written I Used to Love Her with us, happened to be home on holidays at the time. And he was there as well, and he was full of development. And he said, you know, he said, I know I'm not part of the band, he said, but I'll do anything I can to help the show. The idea came up that Paul would buy the Sunday newspaper and sit out in front of the stage reading the Sunday papers while we were playing, and, you know, make it look like he wasn't interested and he was just a bit of messing. We felt it went great. We had a lovely set and there was a very small crowd there, but the crowd was very appreciative. But funnily enough, we were coming off the stage and Barry Lang was standing at the side of the stage and we were getting a bit of applause, and he said, oh, there must be a lot of people from Galway here today. But I think they were from most parts of the country at that stage.
From the bottom of the bill at the first event, the aftermath of the first Fela saw the Saw Doctors skyrocket.
Fela at the time was the biggest shop window, the biggest stage in the country. Definitely an unknown band like ourselves could be seen at. The song had got its foot in the charts on the Sunday already, so we started in the charts at number 27 at the weekend of Fela, and by September 19th we were number one. And then the song stayed at number one for another 9 weeks, I think. At that year then, we re-released N17, and on the back of I Used to Love Her, N17 went up the charts as well. And at Christmas in 1990, the Saw Doctors were number 2 and 3 in the charts, beaten by the number one song for Christmas by Zig and Zag. You can't beat Zig and Zag.
The last artist on stage at the first Fela was Van Morrison, who certainly left an impression.
One of the things Van Morrison did, he got the backstage area cleared before he went on stage, and I'd never seen Van before up close and personal, and he was a superstar, absolute superstar, and we were absolute blow-ins. So to be in the room with him was a wonderful thing. But he acted the superstar, he acted the, you know, don't catch my eye and don't look at me and stay away from me, all of those things. He's very, like, abrupt and... Then we went to see him MCD had left a little area, the backstage, for us to hang out on, but prior to Van going on, he wanted the entire area cleared. You know, he didn't want anyone to see him as he walked to his dressing room. He didn't want to bump into anyone. He didn't want a conversation with anybody. And we all just thought this was a bit hilarious. Very rock and roll.
Van was very particular in relation to who could be around his dressing room, and the area would have to be cleared from the backstage area to go on to Simple Stadium, onto the stage. There was a tunnel, and Van would insist that nobody should be in the tunnel when he passed through the tunnel. And I remember the Saw Doctors, they were very jolly guys, full of mischief and what have you, and they bounced out of the tunnel just as he was in it.
Anyone with a wristband at the time, a backstage wristband, could go up at the side of the stage and watch who was on at the time and come back down or whatever. At the moment that Van Morrison would arrive on site, everything went into lockdown. So you weren't allowed up the side of the stage anymore, and you weren't allowed to go to certain places. And then they brought a red carpet and laid it down from the stage to his dressing room, and a limousine drove him to the dressing room. And then when he was about to go on stage, all the security from all over the place had to come and join hands and stop people from walking on the red carpet. And then the limousine drove Van over the red carpet towards the dressing room, and all the crack was gone out of backstage at this stage. Once the limousine was passed and everything started to just calm down a bit and loosen up again, Davey jumped on the red carpet and he did a bit of a dance, like a kind of a war dance or something, a rain dance, I don't know what you'd call it. But he got a great reaction from the assembled crowd, because I think everybody was feeling similarly about the whole thing.
All was going well on stage, but behind the scenes, Michael Lowry and the rest of the organisers were having to deal with some unexpected problems.
But remember, at about 3 o'clock in the morning, I was at home, and people visited me from the local housing estate. I literally drove out from Thurles to my house to make a complaint. And what had happened was, at the back of one of the housing estates in Thurles, the Moonies had set up a tent. And part of their cult is that they do this drum beat, and the drum beat was going all through the night and obviously disturbing the local residents. So I had to come in, get him to stop and get him to take down the marquee and move to another venue. Like, it's just experiences like that. Like, and I mean, and the Moonies, I'd never seen a Moonie like, but they were, these guys were walking around Thurles, bald heads and their robes. And like, it was, you know, we're here in a country area, and they weren't going to the concerts. But in fairness to them, they were providing, in cases where people got lost, they provided shelter. They were providing counsel to people who were over drinking. So they performed a role.
Good morning to Martin. How are you?
Hello, Jerry. I tell you, what I'm ringing you about is I want to discuss the sheer shock, the sheer horror of failing.
The sheer shock and horror of failing.
Shock and horror, Jerry.
Were you there, were you?
We went down there on Sunday night. I arrived down there at about 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
We went into the square there in Thurles. We went down a side street. And the atmosphere, the only way the atmosphere I can describe it, is absolute sheer hell. We were going down there and we were getting to meet up with a whole rake of other Christians from around Dublin and the countryside.
Christians.
And we were giving out gospel tracts, and we had a bit of street preaching. One girl, I believe, she even dropped dead beside us there early on Sunday in the afternoon.
No, that's not true. Nobody dropped dead. She might have fallen down, all right, but I don't think she died. But anyway, you got together with other Christians.
That's correct.
Kind of to make an assault on Fela, was it?
No, not making an assault. We went down, we just felt we had an urge to just go down there.
But you weren't going down for the rock and roll.
No, not necessarily, no. We were going down there to add something, to get an opportunity to get the gospel across to these people.
What sort of response did you get
from
people?
The response was horrific, Jerry.
Horrific?
Just
really?
Horrific. Oh, I couldn't believe it. You know,
what did you expect, may I ask?
It was unbelievable just to see the sight of it. People just coming out, and they were all, most people, I'd say 90% of the people I've seen were drunk. They were falling all over the place. I tell you, Jerry, we were going through the street, I tell you, at the end of the night. We were going through, and people were actually having sex in the open air in the middle of Thurles at about 1 o'clock in the morning. In the middle, no shame.
Full sexual intercourse.
Oh, it was unbelievable. We just went away, I tell you, I went away from the place in tears. If you would put labels on it, it was like the devil's playground.
Can you understand that there may be some people listening this morning who think that you're describing a fabulous weekend?
That is definitely a deception of the enemy, which is of Satan.
You're up. ball.
Religion started to play a big role in the future of the festival. After the unexpected success of year one, it was clear to Semple Stadium and MCD that they were onto something big. But in the planning for year two, a hierarchical voice with a lot of clout came out against the event.
The Archbishop, Dr. Clifford, was also patron of the Gaelic Athletic Association, and he came out very strongly against the Féile. But every bishop in the country would have had far more influence 25 years ago than they would now. My standard reply was that you have to trust our young people, and that we were all young at once, and that generally speaking people of that age group at that time were very well behaved, and that they were entitled to be entertained, and they were entitled to have the opportunity to enjoy themselves. And I stuck to that line the whole way through, and I didn't deviate from it. As far as I was concerned, the majority of young people that I were meeting were very proud of the fact that for once that they were able to play host to their counterparts from all over Ireland and Europe. And you have to remember that the trip to Tip made Thurles and Tipperary the centre of the universe for that weekend. So the Archbishop opposition to the Féile was sustained. I didn't go into any confrontation with him. I had huge respect for the Archbishop, and all I ever did was try to take on board the views that he had and to deal with them.
In hindsight, was he a great marketing tool?
He was a help in that sense, yes, because it generated publicity and it gave us coverage.
Yeah, well, it was front page. I mean, these things happen. Like, I mean, if you say to an Irish teenager, 20-odd-year-old, you can't do something, any teenager or young adult is going to turn around and say, well, if they say I can't, well, then I'm going to. We had people who probably never even thought of buying a ticket suddenly come and buy a ticket, right? Because it made it the coolest thing going. It was already very cool, but, I mean, he just expedited the whole ticket sales. We were kind of disappointed he didn't come out the following year, you know, and pushed it a bit further. You're
unbelievable. Year two, and the local economy cottoned on to the new markets that were open to them. Eugene Hogan.
There simply wasn't the accommodation available in Thurles to take these crowds, so everybody that wanted to could make money from it. You had people selling sandwiches out through front windows. You had people renting floor space in their living rooms just for people to get a roof over their heads who were attending the concerts.
But then they realised that, hang on a second, I could charge a fiver for Sunday lunch. People need a shower. The showers are cold up at the campsite. £2 a shower. It's about a 2-mile journey to the campsite. Here, hop on the back of my tractor. And there are all these people just around Semple Stadium. You know, cute, realising there was an angle.
Early morning, day three, the morning after the night before. These people have been cooking for their breakfast for a half an hour. How was it?
Oh, it's grand.
fry
up and cornflakes and tea. And
cheese. Brown bread. How many people have you fed so far this morning?
Oh, about, I think I last Coke.
200.
200? Yes.
200 people?
Yes.
Busy, busy?
Very, very busy.
And what's the crowd like? Are they behaving?
Absolutely brilliant.
So in 1991, the Tipperary Star was very much behind the event at the time and produced a supplement for the event. It was an insert into the local paper. I remember faxing over the articles to Kilkenny where it was printed. We produced it. It was inserted into the paper. It was sold in every edition of the paper that went out that week. But we got extra copies and we kept them over in the office, and we had a chat about it, and we said, what are we going to do with these extra copies? So we just said we'd leave them outside the door and people could pick them up. Our office was on Friar Street, which is just off the town centre. So a lot of traffic, a lot of people would get off in the railway station, pass up through Friar Street, passing the Tipperary Star offices, outside which was our supplement, our 16-page supplement. And I remember on day two hearing that that day disappeared, but what apparently happened was that some entrepreneurial person who was attending the concert decided to pick them up and sell them. So they were selling them at £1 or £1 at the time per copy. So definitely our work in the Tipperary Star put at least one person expenses free through Féile for an entire weekend.
The music lineup from the second year onwards had also started to evolve, and MCD took the view that Thurles was ready for something different.
For the first year, ticket sales exceeded what we had planned. I mean, it was evident from the whole buzz and the whole response to the event. There was a demand there, and it was certainly something that could continue. How can we take it a bit further? How can we improve on this year? How can we better it? Okay, well, we have all the Irish acts. You know, do we take in some international acts? So that's where you had, in the second year, you had bands like the Happy Mondays, you had The Farm, Elvis Costello, you had Transvision Vamp.
And that was the year of Elvis Costello and Transvision Vamp, and Wendy from Transvision Vamp was a superstar. We couldn't believe we were backstage with Wendy or in the hotel with her that night either. We couldn't get over it. Costello later wrote an album for her. I think the seeds of that idea were sown that night at Fela, because she just was a superstar. You know, just dripping charisma. Just all she needed were songs.
We went from, you know, from doing the wristbands on the Friday to being the lowest band on the Sunday morning to playing in the stadium full of people who knew the songs. We felt under pressure to put on a big show. So we had the Fathers down for the weekend, and we had Mike Scott on as a guest artist, and we had a troupe from Mocknes with the big monsters and different kinds of stuff going on. We had somebody going across the stage in a Honda 50. It was a time before big screens. We felt we needed something more than just singing the songs in order to captivate people.
The numbers were up in 91, and by 92 the festival had grown to the point of capacity. Headlining were two of the biggest acts in the world that year. Saturday night was topped by Simply Red, whose album Stars was the best-selling album in the UK that year. And on the Sunday, the top spot was held by a man who had spent nearly 4 months the previous autumn at number one, Bryan Adams.
They were two of the biggest acts in the world, and both of them were on the same stage on the same weekend in a town called Thurles. I remember deliberately going onto the stage behind Mick Hucknall and Simply Red, and I did the same on the Sunday night behind Bryan Adams. Every place was packed and everybody had torchlights or candles or what have you. I can still see that moment in my mind's eye.
I remember on the Sunday of 1992, we were in a position whereby we had to actively get on the radio and appeal to fans not to travel to Thurles unless you actually physically had a ticket. But you didn't have internet, you couldn't buy online, and in some cases a lot of people had to actually travel to Dublin in order to buy a ticket, whereas now they've outlets all over the country. The majority of tickets were actually being sold a week before the event. We probably had about 11,000 tickets sold a week out from the event. And I always remember going home one day and saying, I can't believe that, you know, that there's only 11,000 tickets, because the sales used to come in on the fax machine and you used to see them, and they'd say that ticket sales a week out from the event were only 11 or 12,000 tickets. I thought this was going to be the biggest ever disaster of our lives, and you know, having so much gone into it, I couldn't believe it. And we all continued pushing the event, and by that weekend we were sold out. And that just showed you the way people bought tickets at the time. For someone to buy a ticket, they may have to travel a long distance to Dublin to purchase it, to secure it. So a lot of tickets were actually sold last minute and at the venue. Thus the reason why we had to get on the radio and say, listen, stop traveling unless you have a ticket, because we just, you know, the demand, it had just exploded. We couldn't cope with the numbers arriving. The message got out and people took heed of it and decided to turn back.
Bryan Adams was the headliner, but they decided to put the Stunning on last. When we were going on stage, we had to go through the tunnel where all the players go on. It's quite a long tunnel to get to the stage. So they were bringing us up there about 15 minutes or so before we were due on. And we were passing by Bryan Adams and his band as they were coming off, you know. And Joe jokingly said, thanks for warming them up, Brian.
Riding all right. All right through the city at night. I see the stars come out of the sky. Yeah, the bright and hollow sky.
By the fourth year in 1993, the festival welcomed Iggy Pop.
It was really funny because, you know, I thought, I'm coming to Ireland and it's summer, and I thought, oh, it's going to be just a lovely green place, kind of like a little Renaissance fair with flutes and people singing old folk songs. And instead, it was 20,000 really intense little Irish people going, "Hey, Iggy, whoa, up yours," and everything. And it got me really nuts, and I enjoyed it, and that's all I got to say.
Before the lineup was announced, you always had rakes of letters arriving saying, "Can you put this band on? Can you do that band?" You realised that you kind of cracked it when it's turning up on your curriculum. Fela was actually now turning up on the curriculum in the intercert and in the leaving cert. Suddenly it was part of the Irish heritage, and I think there was an adoption of it. You know, we would get phone calls from parents to say that they can't book their family holiday this year because their kids are insisting that they want to be here for Fela, and can we confirm when and where it's taking place and what dates, because they didn't want to book a family holiday then for the kids and to refuse to go on it and lose their deposit with the airlines.
But the tabloids in 1993 focused on a band whose lead singer was possibly the most famous rock star of the time, Michael Hutchence and In Excess. Don't ask me what you know is true. Don't have to tell me I love your inches off. I was standing, you were there. Two worlds collided, and they could never tear us apart.
I remember queuing up backstage to get some food. There was this famous supermodel at the time right in front of me. She was queuing as well. It was Helena Christensen. And I remember just, because she had been in that Chris Isaak video. She was everywhere at the time. I remember just my jaw was hanging open and I was staring at her. Her boyfriend, I didn't realise was in front of her, I just, you know, I looked up and there was this guy kind of glaring at me as if to say, you know, have you seen enough? And it was Michael Hutchence.
It wasn't Iggy or Michael Hutchence who caused the biggest controversy of 1993. It was Christa Berg.
I see you cursed the sun today, very self-righteous. Headline here, fans fury at Christa Berg, it says. Stage strip upsets families at Fela. Apparently had a stripper on stage, and during that saucy number, as it says here in the Sun, Patricia the stripper, a young lady of ample proportions and quite a nice sort of disposition, if the picture on the front of the Sun is anything to go by this morning, apparently took off her you-know-what and showed them to the crowd.
I would have seen Christa Berg as, you know, nice, family-friendly, acceptable, and I made a special effort to get all of the county board. I invited everybody to attend. Christa Berg came on and he was probably two-thirds through his act. I was backstage, so I was adjacent to the press area, and I remember looking at the monitor and I saw this woman on stage flashing her boobs. But by the time I got the second look, I was literally seen this stampede of media moving from the backstage area to go out to the stage, cameras ready. And my first reaction was, oh my God, and the county board are here. I'm dusted, we're done for. So I remember the morning after, we had huge outcry from those who were opposed to the Fela. They seized on the opportunity to criticise us, and I had to go on Morning Ireland. I remember that legend of Morning Ireland, David Hanley, asking me, and what did I think myself? And I said, all I can say is that she was, you know, a young woman and she was very well endowed.
I remember that caused a further outburst.
Everybody was outraged, apparently, according to The Sun. The lady in G-string, of course it has here, and apparently it was a red G-string too. It's not actually a G-string, it's a proper pair of knickers, so it wasn't that disgusting. However, apparently there were members of the audience who were horrified. Probably horrified that she didn't take her knickers off as well.
...1994 was the final year of the trip to Tip. The debt had been paid off, Michael Lowry was about to be made a cabinet minister, and the townspeople of Thurles had had their fill. The last lineup showed the transformation of music in the 5 years. What had started with Meatloaf and Van Morrison passed through Manchester and was finishing up with Britpop and Dance. The Prodigy, The Cranberries and Blur were the headliners. There's no other way, there's no other way. It was also one of the last curtain calls for The Stunning.
Because The Stunning had announced we were splitting up, even though it was the last Fela in Thurles, it was also one of the last gigs for The Stunning. That Fela for us was poignant because it was definitely the end of an era.
We've enjoyed the last 7 years immensely. So this is it anyway. And I can't say we'll see you again because we won't. Goodbye.
We billed 1994 as the last one. We had all given a huge commitment. We had achieved our objective. We had managed to run it. The doom day hadn't happened. It had achieved all its objectives. We had eliminated the debt on Simple Stadium. MCD used that as the foundation for what is now a very, very successful and established business.
Yeah, we hoped that it would stay on in Thurles and it would have been great. But, I mean, there's a life cycle and everything. It was probably time to move on as well. Witness came after that and then it developed further on. Then came Oxygen as well. So Fela would have been the mother of those festivals.
Music journalist Jim Carroll says MCD, one of Ireland's most successful companies, owes an invaluable debt to Fela.
That company would not exist today in the same way if it wasn't for Fela. They learned how to do a music festival. They learned how to make money from a music festival. They got more sophisticated as the years went by about the kind of billing you needed to have. They got more sophisticated as well about how to kind of like market and promote and publicise a festival like that. And it was their apprenticeship. It's amazing. All the good people who went through MCD, they cut their teeth had failed. They learned the ropes. They went in maybe knowing a bit. They came out knowing an awful lot more, you know.
What you've got to remember, if you go to festivals now, there's like 85 stages and different areas. Back then, there was the one stage at one end of the stadium. Primeval in a way, but you know what? There was something about the sense of community. If you come back from the Electric Picnic on a Monday and say, did you see? Chances are people go, ah, no, I was raving away or I was watching a cookery demonstration or I was having a little sleep in my tent. If somebody was playing on the main stage, the only stage at Semple, you saw them.
You could have 40,000 kids hurling abuse at Chris de Burgh. And then after that, you could have Iggy Pop hurling abuse at them.
We've all come down to Thurles, armed with tent poles and guitars, to have the cracking ceilidh 'neath the sparkling summer stars. We're up from Cork and Kerry, and we're down from Donegal.
Hey!
From every end of Ireland, for the Fela one and all. From every end of Ireland, we're here to let it rip, to go kissing, drinking, smoking, dancing, tripping down into
it. It was a unique event. It was very distinctive. in terms of its character and what it had to offer. And I think we left many, many people very happy, and in particular the young people of that generation.
I suppose it was a huge explosion and probably put Ireland on the festival map and the music map.
I loved Thurles, I loved Fela. It was a lovely experience. It was all new to us. We went from the rags to riches of it, and it was a great microcosm of our career. Fela was, really.
I think a lot of it was the sense of being there. You were aware that there was a certain magic in the air. Even now, like, I'd meet people and they'd say, oh, you're a man from The Stunning. And I'd say, yeah, how's it going? I saw you at Fela. Now, I saw you at Fela is probably a catchphrase. I've heard that millions of times.
So the next time you're at a festival queuing up for the poetry tent with your falafel pita and organic rhubarb wine, remember where it all started. We've come a long way from Tipperary.
From every end of Ireland, we're here to let it rip. To go kissing, drinking, smoking, dancing, puking, pissing, eating, sleeping, shagging, slagging, farting, falling, faking, and go tripping down
Fela, the untold story of the trip to Tip, was presented and produced by Will Leahy, with audio supervision by JJ Hartigan. Original Fela live music inserts were produced by Ian Wilson.